Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away. On the News Hour tonight, in an unprecedented move, Romania's election results are thrown out because of Russian interference, putting the NATO member country and its Western allies at a crossroads. We examine the major changes Robert F. Kennedy Jr. could make to federal food regulations if he's confirmed to lead the nation's health department. And Minnesota's first transgender legislator discusses the political backlash against trans rights and whether Democrats are pulling support in the wake of election losses.
This cascade has been coming. I think with the recent election and now what we're seeing at the court, it is going to really crash down.
Welcome to the News Hour. New York police and federal agents tonight say they're gathering more clues on the gunman who fatally shot a healthcare CEO in Manhattan this week, as the search has now become a nationwide manhunt. New York City's police commissioner said in an interview today that investigators have reason to believe the suspect left the city. Investigators are attempting to track the gunman using a trail of surveillance videos, a burner phone, and a water bottle believed to have been dropped when he fled the scene. No arrests have been made in the killing of Brian Thompson, the 50-year-old executive who led United Healthcare, one of the country's largest health insurance companies. Also in New York, the most serious charge of manslaughter has been dismissed against Daniel Penny, a man accused of using a fatal chokehold on a mentally ill and unruly subway passenger last year. The jury today became deadlocked on the charge, which could have sent Penny, a Marine veteran, to prison for as many as 15 years. Jurors have been deliberating since Tuesday and were told to keep deliberating by the judge on a second, lesser charge of criminally negligent homicide when they return next week. Turning overseas now to Syria, where rebels are seizing more territory and are now closing in on the country's third-largest city of Homs. If Homs is lost, it could be a crippling blow to the regime of embattled President Bashar al-Assad. The insurgents, led by a jihadi group known as HTS, already successfully captured the major cities of Aleppo and Hama earlier this week. They've reportedly taken over two towns just north of Homs today. And that is where eyewitness video showed the rebels celebrating as their convoys sped through the streets with little resistance from the Syrian army. The insurgents have vowed to continue their steady march toward the country's capital of Damascus. Russia, a key ally of President Assad, has warned Russian nationals to leave the country. Another of Syria's allies is Iran, and today the UN's nuclear watchdog warned that Tehran is poised to dramatically increase its stockpile of near-weapons-grade uranium. Rafael Grossi told reporters today that Iran has started efforts at several nuclear facilities to more quickly enrich uranium. Iran has denied it's pursuing nuclear weapons. Grossi's comments came just hours after Iran said it successfully carried out a space launch with its heaviest payload ever, something Western experts believe is meant to improve Tehran's ballistic missile program. And a surprising turnaround in South Korea today. The leader of President Yoon Suk-yeol's own party now supports impeaching him. Just yesterday, that same leader said he opposed impeachment. The about-face from ruling party leader Hong Dong-hoon makes suspending Yoon from office more likely. Han said the president poses a great danger to that country.
The president is not even admitting that it was wrong to declare martial law. Therefore, if President Yoon Suk-yeol is allowed to continue running government affairs, there is a significant risk of extreme actions, like reattempting to impose martial law.
With chants of step down, many South Koreans have joined the growing chorus of officials in calling for Yoon's removal, taking to the streets for a third straight night. Impeaching President Yoon would require two-thirds of the National Assembly. They're set to vote on his fate tomorrow. The U.S. job market bounced back in November from a major slowdown the month before. The economy added 227,000 jobs. That's far more than October's revised total of only 36,000. And that's when two hurricanes and worker strikes held job creation down. Just three job categories, that's healthcare, hospitality, and government, accounted for 70% of November's growth, and the unemployment rate rose, but only slightly, from 4.1 to 4.2%. The U.S. government has ordered testing of the nation's raw and unpasteurized milk supply for bird flu after the virus has spread in recent months to more than 700 herds of cows in 15 states. Testing will start in six states, that's California, Colorado, Michigan, Mississippi, Oregon, and Pennsylvania, to better monitor the spread of the virus in dairy. Officials say the risk to people from bird flu remains low. A federal appeals court today unanimously rejected an effort by social media platform TikTok to overturn a law that would require it to part ways with ByteDance, that's its Chinese-based parent company. The law, signed back in April, says TikTok in the U.S. must find a new owner by next month or be shut down nationwide. TikTok is expected to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And stocks closed mixed, but mostly positive to finish out the week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was the only drop for the day, losing more than 100 points. The NASDAQ climbed 0.8% to set a new record. The S&P 500 also at a new all-time high. Still to come on the NewsHour, David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the week's political headlines. And the rebirth of Detroit, Michigan's Central Train Station serves as a microcosm of the city's evolution.
This is the PBS NewsHour from the David M. Rubenstein Studio at WETA in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, a member of NATO and the European Union took a step nearly unheard of, that's throwing out the results of an election. That's what happened in Romania, a country that's been vital to Ukraine's efforts against Russia and also hosts U.S. troops. Romania's constitution annulled the results because of what the sitting government calls a vast influence effort by a foreign actor to boost the candidacy of a candidate dubbed pro-Russian. As Nick Schifrin reports, the effort was largely run on TikTok.
In 2024, when a Romanian strongman wants to prove his manhood, he goes on TikTok. And Calin Georgescu's opponents say if this campaign looks like the Kremlin's playbook, it's because he admires Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Putin is a leader. He loves his country.
Scorns NATO and Ukraine.
Ukraine is an invented state.
And dabbles in conspiracy theories.
Did man reach the moon? I don't think so.
He was also largely unknown, one of 14 candidates running in Romania's presidential election. On November the 5th, Georgescu polled under 1%. 3 weeks later, he won the first round with 23%. Romania's government says that victory was thanks to foreign influence, and for the first time in the country's history, declassified intelligence documents that describe a, quote, campaign to circumvent Romanian law to boost Calin Georgescu's popularity. And the government says that campaign relied heavily on a well-coordinated, popularity-boosting campaign on TikTok. Romanian intelligence says tens of thousands of TikTok accounts suddenly activated right before the election, some after laying dormant for 8 years. And, quote, the activity of the accounts would have been coordinated by a state actor.
Georgescu was supported by a state that NATO describes as the most significant threat to NATO and to Romania's security, and that state is Russia.
Andrei Muraru is Romania's ambassador to the United States.
There are many things, could be shaken if this guy would have become president. A puppet in the Russia's hands, which would be a disaster for our security, for our economy, for our alliances, and for our future.
Romanian intelligence describes a network of TikTok supporters, some paid by a shell company that soon disappeared, all instructed to post unified messages about what they want out of a leader, a family man, who's honest and patriotic. These avoided Georgescu's name, skirting TikTok's own policies against political content. Instead, they relied on hashtags and an army of bots to leave pro-Georgescu comments, playing into TikTok's algorithm and spreading throughout Romania.
at least one TikTok account used by a Romanian citizen to promote candidate Georgescu on social media was financed with over 1 million euro.
Despite Secretary of State Antony Blinken earlier this week.
And now Romanian authorities are uncovering a Russian effort, large in scale and well-funded, to influence the recent presidential election.
Local and U.S. authorities called out pro-Russian actors influencing recent elections in Romania's neighborhoods, Moldova, and using TikTok, last year's parliamentary elections in Bulgaria.
TikTok needs to step up resources to counter information operations.
This week, parliamentarians in Europe challenged TikTok executives.
95 content moderators, 6,000 in Europe. What the hell were they doing during the elections?
Our line of sight goes to our platform, an activity that has taken place on our platform. We do not know what's happening offline.
Today, Georgescu described the decision to annul the first round and delay the second round as a state coup.
Statul de drept este în comă indusă.
The rule of law is in an induced coma, and justice is subordinated to political orders.
Some centrist parties also condemned today's Constitutional Court ruling and argued popular disaffection with the government opened the door to an outsider's campaign.
There was a very real networking process of mobilizing disenfranchised groups across the regions in Romania and across the diaspora.
Clara Volinteru is the director of the German Marshall Fund for the Black Sea region.
Grievances from the regions, from rural communities, from categories of the public that don't feel they are taken seriously with regards to the decreased standards of living, with regards to their fears, uncertainties, traditional identities. So there is a lot of fear that the Russian narratives are exploiting.
Today's court decision cannot be appealed.
Fiecare sport pe care l-am practicat.
But it hasn't blocked the appeal of Georgescu TikTok videos that continue to gain views. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
President-elect Trump's nomination of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the Department of Health and Human Services has raised a number of questions in the public health community about Kennedy's long history of opposing vaccines. It's also put a spotlight on a number of other comments he's made, including about what millions of Americans eat and drink each day. For more on those claims and what the science says, here's William Brangham.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is trained as an environmental lawyer, but in recent years, he's focused almost exclusively on public health, and he stirred a great deal of alarm with some of his claims. So we're going to dive into a few of them here to better understand what the research tells us, what those claims tell us about Kennedy, and what this could mean for Americans should he get confirmed as health secretary. Let's start with ultra-processed foods. Kennedy has vowed to remove them from school lunches.
We are literally poisoning our children systematically for profit.
Ultra-processed means foods that have been altered in a factory with added dyes, sweeteners, or preservatives. And they tend to be high in calories, sugar, fat, and sodium. This category contains a lot of things you'd expect. Sodas, frozen pizzas, hot dogs, but also things you might not expect, like flavored yogurts, plant milks, whole grain breads, and cereals. The U.S. has been slower than other developed countries to regulate ultra-processed foods, even though the consensus on their health impacts, including from the National Institutes of Health, is quite clear.
There's very strong scientific evidence about this link between consuming ultra-processed foods and a wide array of health outcomes. In addition to that, there's a large body of observational studies that show links between ultra-processed foods and things like type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and also mental health.
Kennedy's attempt to regulate these foods would likely face opposition from well-funded industry groups, politicians, as well as members of the public who may lack access to affordable, healthier food. And some worry that his approach, he's vowed to fire anyone at the Food and Drug Administration who stands in his way, could be counterproductive.
We're not doing enough, that's clear. I am very concerned about the idea that RFK Jr. would wipe out entire branches of the federal government or kick out the scientists who've been working on these issues for ages, because those are exactly the type of experts that we need. And if that were to happen, there's a real risk that we could end up worse off in the long run than we are now.
Now to raw milk. That's milk that hasn't been pasteurized, which means heating it to about 161 degrees Fahrenheit for 15 seconds to kill viruses and bacteria. In recent years, a small online community has argued that raw milk contains good bacteria and pasteurization kills nutrients that can help prevent asthma, allergies, and illness.
This is why you should be drinking raw milk.
It is easier for your body to digest.
Raw dairy actually has active and bioavailable enzymes, probiotics.
Raw milk also contains over 700 species of commensal bacteria in the actual raw milk fluid.
Kennedy recently wrote that he'll end the Food and Drug Administration's, quote, war on public health, including its, quote, aggressive suppression of many things, including raw milk. Yet there's no evidence for any of these beneficial claims about raw milk, while there's plenty of evidence that drinking it increases the risk of foodborne illnesses from things like salmonella, listeria, and E. coli, which can be deadly.
We have 100 years plus of data showing that there is the potential of pathogens present in raw milk. So there's a clear risk, and no study has yet shown any nutritional benefit from consuming raw milk. And in fact, most of these claims can be relatively easily debunked.
Children, the elderly, pregnant women, and those with weakened immune systems are the most at risk from infection. And the recent bird flu outbreak presents yet another risk to consider. While there are no known cases of humans becoming infected from drinking raw milk, scientists warn the virus seems to concentrate in the udders of infected cows. And at least one raw milk producer in California recently issued a recall after detecting bird flu in its product.
Fortunately, pasteurization inactivates it. So we have a simple technique that kills the pathogens, and thankfully now it kills this avian flu virus that could be present in milk. And the levels are high. This is not a trivial amount.
Now, could Kennedy change the rules on raw milk? The federal government doesn't determine whether it's legal to sell. That's left up to the states, and most states do allow it to be sold at some level. But since 1987, the FDA has prevented raw milk from being sold across state lines, so that's something Kennedy could impact.
It would lead to increased sales of raw milk, for sure, and it would increase the amount of food illnesses and outbreaks.
Finally, let's talk about fluoride in drinking water. Just before the election, Kennedy posted this on X, vowing that the Trump administration would advise U.S. water systems to remove fluoride, which he called an industrial waste associated with a number of health conditions. Backing up a bit, fluoride is a naturally occurring mineral that's commonly found in soils and rocks. And since 1962, the federal government has recommended adding it to our drinking water to strengthen the enamel in our teeth to help protect against tooth decay.
The CDC has hailed fluoridating public water systems to be one of the greatest achievements in public health in the 20th century. And that's because having fluoride in water has reduced dental cavities, especially in children. But at the same time, it's also true that that value of fluoridating public water is much less now that we do have fluoridated toothpaste.
The amount of fluoride is important here. Since 2015, the CDC has recommended 0.7 milligrams per liter of water. An NIH review this year showed that at twice that level, there are impacts on children's IQ and development. It's important to note that those studies mostly looked at other countries where levels are higher, but there have been higher levels in some communities in the U.S. The Environmental Protection Agency currently requires that officials keep levels below 4 milligrams per liter.
This is an issue of dosing, but I think it's also an issue of informed consent. I can understand why there are activists who are saying, well, I just didn't know this. And had we known that the level of fluoride in our community water system is higher than what's recommended, maybe we would have taken different steps during our pregnancy or with baby formula. And I think that that kind of nuanced communication needs to happen. And without it, that actually breeds distrust.
Ultimately, the decision to fluoridate drinking water and how much is left to states and municipalities, which follow federal guidance. So there, Kennedy could influence what local authorities ultimately choose to do. Overall, public health voices say that on this issue and others, Kennedy has a record of combining good information with bad.
But then he also has views on issues like vaccines that simply are disproven by the science. And I'm very concerned about someone like that who basically is an activist and not a scientist, holding the position of overseeing our nation's scientific and medical and public health agencies. Because ultimately, a person overseeing these agencies should be guided by science.
In our next explainer, we'll dive further into that issue, Kennedy's many years opposing vaccines. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
President Joe Biden's pardon of his son Hunter has drawn scrutiny from both sides of the aisle as several of President-elect Trump's picks continue to face heavy scrutiny on Capitol Hill. On that and other issues shaping the transition, we turn now to the analysis tonight of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Good to see you both.
Hey, Jeff.
So let's start our conversation where we started the week. President Biden's sweeping pardon of his son, Hunter, which was notable because he came to office vowing to restore the independence of the Justice Department, and he repeatedly said he would not pardon or commute his son's sentence. Jonathan, in your view, was it justified, and what's the lasting impact?
Yes, it was justified. When the president said that he would not pardon his son, wouldn't grant clemency, the facts on the ground were completely different. It's the middle of a presidential campaign. He was the candidate for president, didn't want to be viewed as interfering. He's no longer the candidate. His vice president is the presidential nominee. I am almost certain, 99% certain, that President Biden was hoping that Vice President Harris would win and that this would not be an issue. But when the person who won the race by vowing a campaign of retribution, revenge, naming the Biden family in general and Hunter Biden in particular as someone or groups of people he wanted to go after if he won election, of course, the president looks at the facts that I cannot allow that to happen to my son. And I understand the criticisms and the brickbats that the president is taking. But for some Democrats to be complaining about the fact, well, you've ruined norms and you've given him an avenue, have they not been paying attention to who Donald Trump is either during the campaign or during his 4 years as president the first go round? And these are the same people who would be yelling at Biden had he not done something and then President Trump took action against Hunter Biden. Why didn't you save your son? Why didn't you help your son when you had the opportunity to do so when you were president? He's done it.
What about that, David? Did the intervening events, the re-election of Donald Trump, the fact that Hunter Biden would have been at the mercy of a Trump Justice Department, and that Donald Trump was very clear about seeking revenge against his perceived enemies, the Bidens chief among them, does any of that change the calculus in your opinion?
Not to me. Hunter Biden has already been convicted. He was about to get sentenced. This is not going to be a Trump thing. That was already happening. I think what happened for Joe Biden, it became less politically painful to do it, so he did it. You know, I've learned that Democrats have been running against corruption, against nepotism, against all the bad things Donald Trump has done. And to run against those things, you have to have a place to stand. I have to have a place to stand on legitimacy. And I do care about norms. I think our society, our democracy, the Constitution is built on laws. But within the way the government functions, there are norms of behavior upon which our democracy depends. And one of those norms is that we have a pardon. The president gets presidential pardon power, but he cannot abuse it by just taking his family out of the picture. In my view, he cannot abuse it by giving pre-pardons to people who haven't been convicted of anything. The way democracies fall is that the practices that make the democracy work get slowly abandoned step by step. And obviously, Donald Trump is the guy abandoning those norms leap by leap. But it's important to me that we have one party that actually does defend on those norms, defends on legitimacy, and just doesn't go in for freewheeling nepotism.
There's the defense of norms, and Jonathan, we've heard Republicans already say that this pardon proves that it's Joe Biden who has politicized the Justice Department, not Donald Trump. whether that's accurate or not, I mean, it certainly could be politically effective, especially if Donald Trump does what he says he intends to do, and that's issue pardons for the folks who were convicted in connection to the attack on the Capitol on January 6th.
Yeah, he said he was going to do it. He said he intended to do it. He's going to do it. Whether President Biden pardoned his son or not, Trump is going to do it. No one's going to be surprised. And, you know, I take your point, David, about, you know, the erosion of norms. At a certain point, you got to stop bringing a melon baller to a knife fight.
Well, how should Democrats think about that? Because you could argue that Donald Trump has really benefited from this asymmetry in our politics, where it feels like there's one party that's held to account to preserve the norms and to preserve the standard way of doing things in Washington.
Yeah, well, you know, I think throughout these years, the Justice Department has done, justice system has done a reasonably good job of having a neutral law. They indicted and convicted Donald Trump. They did not go with Trump on whether the election was stolen. They indicted and convicted lots and lots of January 6 people. So to me, the thing we have to defend here is the justice system. And defending the justice system as an objective, truth-seeking institution seems to require that as many people as possible treat it as a truth-seeking enterprise. And if you give, say, pre-pardons, which is what they're talking about now, you've basically taken a whole sweep of people who haven't been accused of anything and saying, no, the law's not going to apply to you. I think if Trump goes after Liz Cheney, say, Liz Cheney did nothing illegal, I think the justice system she'll have her day in court if such a thing happens, and I think she'll be vindicated because she hasn't done anything close to illegal.
The thinking, though, among some folks at the White House is that just the idea of a Trump administration launching an investigation, whether or not it leads to a prosecution, that is reputationally damaging, and it's also really costly. And so you pre-pardon these folks to help get around it.
And, you know, look, I understand the motivation behind the administration and the president looking into this, thinking about it, even putting it out there that they're talking about it, which to me, the story feels like a trial balloon. I won't be surprised if it doesn't happen. Maybe they offer it and give the option to the folks. You don't have to take it, but it's there if you want it. And I think for some people, weighing the choice between having to sort of admit to something you didn't do or bankrupting your family, that's a hard place to be. And having that option might be something that people want. But if the president doesn't do it, great. If the president does do it, not too thrilled about it because it doesn't make too much sense to me. I'm not a lawyer, but I understand the motivation behind it.
It would be a novel use of presidential power. Let's put it that way. Let's talk about Pete Hegseth, because Donald Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon is working to shore up faltering support among senators over allegations that he committed sexual assault, that he drank to excess, that he was ousted from two nonprofits for mismanagement. We should say these are all things that he denies. The vice president-elect, J.D. Vance, is standing by Pete Hegseth. Here's what he said earlier today.
Importantly, Pete Hegseth is going to get his appearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee, not a sham hearing before the American media. We believe that Pete Hegseth is the right guy to lead the Department of Defense. That's why President Trump nominated him. We're not abandoning this nomination.
So, David, what does this nomination and the defense of Pete Hegseth at this point tell you about how Donald Trump is thinking about his second term?
Yeah, well, first, it seemed like Hegseth, all the stories came out. It seemed like Trump was waffling, well, maybe this wasn't so great an idea. They sort of floated the idea that Governor Ron DeSantis might get the pick. But then Hegseth did the smart thing. He attacked the media. He had these meetings on Capitol Hill. He's surrounded by reporters, and he lavished an attack on all
Even
the
though
media.
His previous job was in the media as a Fox News personality on the weekends, show, but yeah.
That's questionable. Yeah. He was in the media. And so Donald Trump said, oh, he's bashing the media. Like it. And so he has successfully rallied the administration. But as J.D. Vance just said, this is not going to be decided by those of us in the media. It's going to be decided by the confirmation hearing and by the FBI report. And if he does poorly in the confirmation hearing, then he becomes unpopular. Then he's still in a very vulnerable spot. But it's so tragic because the Pentagon is in desperate need of reform. And you only reform an institution when you know something about it. And Pete Hegseth does not have that knowledge.
And the key thing here about the FBI vetting, it's one thing, you know, a sham trial by the media. You go before the Senate confirmation hearing. And it, bashing the media is great. But once you start filling out that FBI vetting form and once you start having interviews with the FBI, One thing that folks don't realize is lying to the FBI is a felony. And so Hegseth is, I think, being pushed into this corner where we'll see if he gets out. But he shouldn't be Secretary of Defense, not by a long shot.
Lastly, we saw Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy on the Hill this week. They are leading up this new effort in the second Trump administration to cut government spending and dramatically reshape the way the federal government works. And I saw a quote from Louisiana Senator John Kennedy, who is known for his folksy sense of humor. And he said this about this effort to cut government spending. He said, "My experience has been trying to convince people to cut government spending. It's kind of like going to heaven. Everybody's ready to go to heaven. Nobody wants to make the trip." That's a great line, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, do you think they're going to have any success at this?
They could have some small successes, but they're talking about cutting $2 trillion, and that's literally impossible unless you go after Social Security and Medicare. And so they're not going to have that kind of effect. Then you get to the problem when you actually want to trim government spending. Sometimes you have to spend more money in order to do that. Mm-hmm. So all this, mostly the government is a check writing machine, either to defense contractors or to people, you know, senior citizens and everybody. But if you're going to supervise the contracts, you have to have a lot more people working for the General Accounting Office and other places that will actually make sure the money is well spent. And so you have to hire more people. And so it doesn't work the way Ramaswamy's talking about it, the way it works. It doesn't work the way Elon Musk is talking about it. Nonetheless, there's so much room for reform in the way the government is working that they could have some small and significant successes.
10 seconds, what's your prediction?
It ain't ever going to happen. Look, good luck to them getting Congress to agree to cut something that happens to be in their district.
All right, Jonathan Capehart and David Brooks, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jack.
The issue of transgender rights has rarely been so prominent in American politics, from presidential campaign ads to the election of the first openly trans member of Congress to arguments this past week at the U.S. Supreme Court. William Brangham is back to talk with one recent pioneer about how she sees this current moment.
My guest is no stranger to both the triumphs and the vitriol surrounding transgender rights in America. 2 years ago, Lee Finke became the first trans person elected to the Minnesota State Legislature. And even though she endured numerous threats, she leveraged her position and a Democratic majority to help pass legislation protecting other trans people in her state. Lee Finke, so nice to have you on the program. As I said, you've been in office almost 2 years now, but this is a seemingly very fraught time for trans rights in this country. With this past election and all of those attacks, the first openly trans member of the U.S. Congress, and now the Supreme Court case this week. I just wonder how has this been for you the last few months?
Yeah, it's been a lot. And you know, thank you so much for inviting me and for having trans voices on your show. I think what we have seen over the last couple of months, I mean, it is a compounding pile of difficulty for a community that is very small, that we receive so much outsized attention, given the impact and size that we have in the communities that we exist in. We're struggling. We're all struggling and trying to figure out what all of this is going to mean.
You were here while the Supreme Court was arguing this case. That case centered around Tennessee's attempt to ban trans care for trans children. And the justices had a lot of different arguments about that case. And I wonder, listening to what they had to say, what stood out to you?
I mean, what stood out to me is that we are trying to figure out a very complicated answer to a very simple question, which is that gender-affirming care is healthcare, and healthcare decisions belong to families and doctors, and they do not belong to politicians or the courts. We do not do this for other forms of healthcare. There is a very specific reason that trans people's healthcare is under the microscope that it is, and it is because we are trans. There is no way to understand this other than discrimination based on our identity. And that this question continues to be asked and continues to be litigated and now is in front of the Supreme Court. It's incredibly difficult to hear people finding reasons to further discriminate and alienate trans people, especially our kids.
And it also seemed that the justices wanted to talk about other trans-related issues, bathrooms, sports. I mean, do you feel like this is just the beginning of an ongoing cascade?
Yes, this cascade has been coming. I think with the recent election and now what we're seeing at the court, it is going to really crash down. There is no reason to be talking about trans kids in sports. That is not a problem. There is no reason to be talking about trans people using the bathroom. That is not a problem. The only reason we are here is because it is politically valuable. And until the conservative Republican institutions realize that this is a human, that they are hurting human people and they are not just making hypothetical political arguments, they are going to continue.
Yes, we've certainly seen those. I mean, Representative Nancy Mace here in Congress, as soon as we had a trans member of Congress, she introduces a bill to ban trans people using bathrooms that don't conform to the sex of their birth. President Trump has vowed to get trans kids out of children's sports. I mean, do you think that this is, again, just, it seems like the GOP is very interested in pursuing this issue, even though you're arguing it's not really an issue.
No, it is not an issue. We have existed in the culture, whether or not other people have noticed. Now that our visibility is here, there is a pushback, and that pushback is getting extreme. You mentioned Nancy Mace and her, you know, it was a historic moment for us to have a first congressperson elected in Sarah McBride, and she didn't even get to be sworn in before she had the whole apparatus of the Republican House majority centered on her specifically, dehumanizing her, taking away her fundamental basic dignity. It's beyond reproach.
President-elect Trump, as you well know, spent tens of millions of dollars attacking Kamala Harris over her stance on trans rights. And some Democrats are arguing that Democrats' embrace of trans rights cost them this election. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton said that the Democratic Party is, quote, out of touch on trans issues and said, quote, I have two little girls. I don't want them getting run over on a playing field by a male or formerly male athlete. But as a Democrat, I'm supposed to be afraid to say that. What do you make of that argument?
It's wrong. It's hurtful. It's despicable to hear coming from someone inside of the Democratic establishment. The National Democratic Party has accepted trans people into their coalition. We have been a part of not just their voting base, but they have embraced us and protected us and moved to have us be protected under their banner. If they are going to adopt the framing of Republicans, which is what Congressman Moulton did in that quote that you just read, if they are going to try to embrace the dehumanizing, misgendering language of the Republicans, then it is going to become more and more difficult for trans people to remain a willing partner in that coalition. And 90% of trans people voted for Kamala Harris. We are small, but we are mighty, and we hear that. We hear that, and we are worried about what it means for the future.
All right, Representative Lee Finke of Minnesota, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
A restoration of past glory, a renovation toward future growth, potential consequences and conflicts in the present. That is the story of Michigan Central, a grand old and now new addition to Detroit's economic and cultural life. Senior arts correspondent Jeffrey Brown reports for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
We spent a lot of time researching and understanding the different types of materials.
Above soaring ceilings, all around columns, ornate chandeliers, arched windows. This is the Grand Hall of Detroit's Michigan Central, an historic train station newly restored to glory. Lead architect Richard Hess is with the firm Quinn Evans.
This is the original Tennessee rose-colored marble flooring.
Much of it reconstructed as it was, though not the old wooden benches on which several thousand travelers once waited every day.
All these benches were gone, but we wanted to keep the reflection of what was here before and sort of that token of memory.
It's like the ghost of a bench.
Yes, it's like the ghost of a bench. That's a great way to put it.
The ghosts, both friendly and destructive, are everywhere, flitting through hallways and history. The original 1913 building, located in Detroit's Quirktown neighborhood and designed by the same team behind New York's Grand Central, was the gateway to the city, a symbol of its industrial power. then the fourth tallest building in Detroit, the tallest train station in the world. But as Detroit's fortunes changed, Michigan Central became a different symbol of decline. After the last train left in 1988, the station sat abandoned and came close to being torn down. A scene of decay, broken glass and walls, a derelict graffiti heaven, water damage throughout, as Hess saw on his first visit here in 2011.
And the entire basement area was flooded with water, millions of gallons of water. It's pitch black, there's no windows, there's no lighting, really spooky, calm. And you raised up the flashlights, and right on the column in front of us, it was spray painted, "This is where you die."
Really?
Chills immediately went up my spine. I said, like, that's it, I'm out of here, I want to go. But that was my first impression of the train station.
In 2018, Ford Motor Company bought the building with an eye toward a major contribution to Detroit's revitalization. And restoration began for real, testing its structural integrity, studying archives to match materials or replace lost items. A vast project including engineers, designers, historians, hundreds of construction workers and craftsmen. Several examples of what was were left on view. A graffiti hallway, columns pitted by water.
You wanted us to see the damage?
Telling the story of Michigan Central Station, not just the way it was 100 years ago, but also what happened to Michigan Central during its time that it was abandoned was really important.
But this is more than just a nod to the past. The station will house offices. Ford has already moved into several floors, and eventually retail, art spaces, a hotel, and plenty more. And crucially, Ford also bought and restored another landmark building next door, one designed by famed architect Albert Kahn and opened in 1936, first as a post office, then book depository for Detroit's public schools. It was abandoned in 1987 after a fire left it a shell. Now it's been remade into NewLab, a home for innovators and tech startups. Mary Culler is president of Ford Philanthropy and headed the Michigan Central and NewLab project.
And so the vision has always been about creating an innovation, tech, and cultural hub that not only talks and thinks about sort of what are the jobs of the future, but how do you bring people together to really solve the biggest problems? And, you know, those cannot be solved alone. So bringing together, think about it, corporations, startups, nonprofits, artists, all kinds of people that are all under kind of the same roof, thinking about what those problems are and thinking about how to solve them for the future. It's really a dynamic and energetic place.
And I know the Google guys are good friends of mine, so I go up there sometimes.
32-year-old Darren Riley, a graduate of Carnegie Mellon, is one of NewLab's young core of entrepreneurs as co-founder and CEO of Just Air, a company that provides data on air quality for use by government agencies, public health services, and individuals in the community suffering, as he does, from asthma and related problems. It's a business with a social impact goal.
I dedicated myself after college that I'm only going to focus on problems that actually move the needle on the people that I love. I think a lot of times when we talk about technology, we don't think of how to make sure it's inclusive, not only inclusive, but actually solving the problems that hit home for those marginalized communities.
He's also a founding member of Black Tech Saturdays, where people come together to share knowledge of technology and how to start and grow companies.
We're seeing it make a real impact. We have a community through the ups and downs, through the ups to celebrate you, cheer you on, keep going, and the downs to celebrate you and say, hey, keep going.
Inevitably, this is a story of ups and downs amid change, as Michigan Central's revitalization now brings more change to the surrounding neighborhoods, including historic Mexican Town, named after the influx of immigrants who settled here beginning in the 1920s to be part of Detroit's industrial growth.
You take this.
Tomasita Alfaro Kohler, known to all as Tammy, has had a front row seat from the time she first worked in her grandparents' store, Honey Bee Market.
Michigan Central is my front yard.
Yeah.
It's
That's quite an imposing building for our front yard.
Yes, it is. People would say, oh, that this needs to be torn down. And I know it felt like hopeless, but in my heart, in my husband's heart, we felt like this area could come back.
I'm just making sure you have signs. You have
Tammy and husband Ken Kohler bought Honeybee in 1996, and it continues as a thriving and much-loved local market. Today, she says, the streets are safer, and across the street is a new apartment building. At the same time, though, some older customers and surrounding business are being priced out. The challenge, she says, finding a balance.
It's because it can't just come in and say all of a sudden change the whole look of the city without considering the old, because we have history. And we're thankful for the investment. We are all thankful for the investment of the new that came in. But at the same time, you have to appreciate the old that sustained the city and kept holding on to the hope that it could be better.
While all this plays out, Michigan Central is now a prime example of a growing and, says architect Richard Hess, welcome trend in urban design.
Today, for the first time ever, there is more work in the architectural community on existing buildings, on adapting existing buildings, than new construction.
Really?
It's been a huge swing over time, but there are so many benefits.
Those include sustainable building practices as well as ties to community history. And speaking of history, there is a hope to bring back train service to Michigan Central one day as well. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in Detroit.
And we'll be back shortly, but first take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like this one on the air. For those of you staying with us, The Late Show's Stephen Colbert and his wife Evie are sharing the ingredients that make their partnership work, especially in the kitchen. Amna Nawaz met up with them earlier this year to discuss their new cookbook, Does This Taste Funny? Here's a second look at that conversation.
At New York City's Porchlight Bar.
I've never been interviewed in a bar before. This is nice.
What do we got here? That's a great question. What is this dessert?
Over a spread of southern specialties.
Oh, nice. Oh,
wow. And then biscuits and honey.
Stephen and Evie McGee Colbert open up about their shared love of their shared hometown, Charleston, South Carolina, where they first met in their 20s and that inspired this cookbook together. The book, a compendium of everything from seafood specials and party food to desserts and drinks, started coming together during COVID. The Colberts, along with their three mostly grown children, were locked down together in their Charleston home. The family turned their focus to a joint project, compiling recipes of the food they loved and the stories behind it.
It feels like it's as much about your family history in this book as it is about the food. Is that fair?
Absolutely, very fair.
Yeah, it's about the lives we lived growing up there, not just the food.
Well, and when we started, we gathered up recipes that we have fed our kids for years, but we also reached out to family members. And one of the things that was fun for me is I worked on it with my mother, so we would go hunting. She couldn't remember. Like, for example, her pickled shrimp recipe is in the cookbook. I think we made it for her four times, and she kept saying, no, that's not quite right.
The book is dedicated to Evie's mom, not just because she was a great hostess and a cook of her own, but because we were writing this book near the end of your mother's life.
Right. She wasn't well, so I would be with her, you know, a medical appointment or at the hospital or something, and it was something else to talk about, which was really nice for her and nice for me. And, you know, I think neither one of us sort of knew where we were headed in the future, but it gave us a present moment to be together.
Food is at the heart of major moments for the couple, including the moment they first met.
You've told about the moment you saw Evie, you knew. You knew she was the one that you were going to marry. Did you cook for her? Is that how you helped to woo her or no?
No, you didn't.
Actually, I don't think I was very good. Like there's a recipe in Charleston, you know, it's a shrimp dip, but we call it shrimp paste because everything in Charleston has to have an old name. And so my family made shrimp paste and our recipe was terrible. And the first thing I ever made for Evie was shrimp paste, which is not the most attractive sounding dish.
Well, you used canned shrimp.
And it was terrible.
There were budget constraints.
Exactly.
The first dish Evie cooked for Stephen, her family's famous cheese biscuits.
Her family would make thousands and thousands of cheese biscuits.
That is
and
a
distribute
family
them
recipe.
Around.
Yeah, it's a family recipe. Yeah. My mother did it every Christmas, all year long. They were in the house. It was her go-to, someone's coming over, you put a plate of those out, just like our first date. I wasn't ready.
She was
ready.
Late, so I went into the bar with her dad.
On purpose. You got to you gotta make him wait a little.
You miss. You miss right there. Hello, hi. Lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you.
What's your name?
The book isn't their first collaboration. That came during pandemic lockdowns when Evie jumped in to help Stephen host the Late Show from their South Carolina home on Sullivan's Island.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
We call it the Ed Sullivan's Island Theater.
Was that sort of your first professional time working together?
It was.
Yes, we were terrified.
Yeah.
Well,
I was terrified. Her eyes went wide when she said, yes, it was.
It was. Yes. It really was. And there were very funny moments that now are funny at the time were slightly stressful where he would turn to me and say something like, I can't hear Tom Hanks. And I would say, I don't know what to do.
Because she was my crew on the couch with a headset and all these wires around her. She's like, I don't know what button to push.
The polls are showing that we won by numbers you've never even heard of. We got 17%, 100 didgeridoo, and of course...
Back in his studio, Stephen Colbert is back to doing what he does best, bringing levity to a heavy time and sometimes heavy topics.
Is there such toxicity around the discourse
sure.
sometimes? Do you find it's harder today to be funny about what's going on in the world?
It's a gift to us that we get to go out there and do the jokes for the audience, and we get to realize that we're not crazy, and that these things that are driving us crazy or making us anxious are also resonating with the audience. But, you know, toxicity itself is worth making fun of. Like, that's just the fact of how bad things are is something you have to make fun of.
Yeah. Is it the kind of thing where Evie, he leaves it all at work, or do you talk about these things at home?
Oh, we talk, unfortunately, we talk about it a lot.
All the time, yeah. We've always been news junkies.
Always been news junkies, but yeah, we do talk about it.
PBS NewsHour, number one.
Hey, how are you? I can get here.
The Late Show on CBS is number one among all late night shows, some of which are struggling with the changing landscape. Audiences may come to Colbert for the laughs, but seem to be staying for more.
We have to learn more about trust and peace and learning about each other rather than
rare moments of engaged conversation like this from his recent interview with Nancy Pelosi.
As you can see from the continuing protest out here, that answer is unsatisfying to some people.
There were these pro-Palestinian protesters, and she said, you know, I can't hear what they're saying. And you took a moment to make sure she heard the questions that they were asking. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I want to be respectful to my guests, but I had promised the people who had protested during the first act of the interview with Nancy Pelosi that I would ask the question if they would sit and listen to what she had to say. And also, there's no way to move on from a subject unless you address the subject.
That feels like something you may have learned in 30 plus years of marriage together, yeah. No?
Yes,
well,
it is
I do
good
think
to
listening.
Address the subject.
Well, and listening, you know, and I think what you did so well at that moment, that's what conversation is about, that we have to listen to the issue that is bothering someone so you can respond to it. I think that's also in our marriage. You have to listen and then be able to respond. And I think we do, we've managed to figure out how to do that, you know.
I'm sorry, I missed some of that.
There are more collaborations and laughs to come as the two run a production company together.
Stephen and Evie Colbert, thank you so very much. Such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely. Appreciate
it. Cheers.
Remember, there's a lot more online, including our PBS News Weekly program that looks at some of the biggest stories from around the world this past week, from the civil war in Syria to cyber threats stemming from China. You can find that on our YouTube page. And be sure to watch Washington Week with The Atlantic tonight on PBS. Moderator Jeffrey Goldberg and his panel discuss Pete Hegseth's imperiled nomination to be Secretary of Defense and President Biden's possible use of preemptive pardons. And on the next PBS News Weekend, how a family of Christmas tree farmers in North Carolina overcame the devastation from Hurricane Helene to get their trees to market and even send one to the White House. That's tomorrow right here on PBS. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for spending part of your evening with us, and have a great weekend.